That giant solar flare the sun sent in our direction this week, how does all that solar stuff work? Well, this hour we're going to talk about the sun's explosive behavior, how that space weather affects our satellites, airplanes, and the power grid. Plus, will that be cash, credit, or mobile phone? We'll look at the latest way to pay, the mobile wallet. Google already has one for Android phones. How soon before this catches on? When might Apple get in on the game? Finally, magnetic soap. An attractive way to clean up oil spills, perhaps? All that and our video pick, Ode to Ice. Why an ice sculpture is like a science experiment, dueling chainsaws after this break. Stay with us. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. After the Deepwater Horizon spill, BP poured nearly 2 million gallons of dispersants into the Gulf of Mexico. The goal, of course, is breaking up oil slicks, making them dissolve into ocean waters, sort of like how you squirt dish soap on a greasy frying pan to get the oil to wash away with the water. The problem is, after you dump all that soap into the Gulf, the soap stays there. My next guest has developed something that could be the solution, the soap that has iron in it so that you can suck up the soap with a magnet. How do they do it? And could we really use something like this next time there's a big oil spill? Julian Eastow is a professor in the School of Chemistry at the University of Bristol in the UK. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira.
Hey.
From the United Kingdom.
Thanks for joining. How did you get this idea? It sounds so simple yet so easy.
Well, to explain that, I'd like to propose an interactive experiment for you and your listeners. Would that be okay?
Absolutely.
Well, the experiment works best if you're in the kitchen. So go over to the fridge and take one of those picture fridge magnets. You know, with Niagara Falls, Las Vegas, or Disneyland on it.
Right.
Then now go over to the kitchen sink with the magnet. Next, put the magnet against the bottle of dish soap. Right. What happens?
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. That's because normal soap is not magnetic. Just as you said, you can't control where it goes. Gravity does that, just sucks it down the drain. Now, Ira, we've been making soaps and surfactants with unusual properties for some years. Have you ever thought of a soap you could turn on with the flick of a switch? A light-sensitive surfactant. We made one of those about 5 years ago. And next we thought, why not try magnets? Would it be possible to make surfactants or soaps that respond to magnets? Well, if that's true, then you stand a chance to control where the soap does and where it doesn't go. Our motivation for this was just good old-fashioned scientific inquisitiveness.
So you created the soap that is magnetic, so that the soap dissolves the grease, keeps the grease with it, and then you can just magnetize it away with a magnet.
Yeah, it sounds incredible, but it's true. I was witnessing the experiments in my laboratory at the University of Bristol this afternoon with graduate students. We were making emulsions with lube oil, our magnetic soap, and we were moving them around using magnets. The emulsions can be collected up.
And now I've got
amazing.
I got an experiment for you now. Tell me if this is possible. Let's say that you can put your soap, you can disperse your magnetic soap into a harbor. Can you magnetize the hulls of ships so that they sort of scoot around the harbor soaking up all the grease on collecting on their hulls, and then you just clean them off when they get back to the harbor?
Well, Ira, I haven't thought about that. It sounds feasible to me, but I think we would have to do some tests in the laboratory. I'm not sure about if you can maintain magnetism in the hull of a ship.
Uh-huh. But do you think you can do this with an oil spill by collecting up all the grease later on?
Well, in principle, that's right. That's what we've demonstrated in the laboratory. We started with chemicals that are relatives of common or garden soaps. Mm. We kept the organic part of the molecule, the one which dissolves oily substances, but we chemically modified the ionic part, which makes the compound water soluble. And it's quite simple, really. We replaced the normal ions with magnetic ions. Those ions contain the element iron.
And voila, because the soap molecule, as you say, is fascinating to begin with. One end likes to stick in the grease, and one end likes to stick in the water, and that's why it works so well. And you basically took the water end and put a piece of iron in there.
Yeah, we've done this with iron. That's in the paper which has been published recently, but we've even used other magnetic units. I can't disclose them right now because they're under a secrecy agreement. But we are now starting to optimize the chemistry, and that is now really exciting. I think what this research shows is the first stage in any scientific breakthrough, the essential proof of principle. And once the proof of principle has been established and has been communicated to the scientific community, that's when it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
That's when the collective consciousness, those thousands and thousands of scientific minds, get to work coming up with ideas that you would never have thought of.
Yeah, it's so once you show that this can happen and people will say, you know, this is what I could do with it. Sort of like
now it was suggested to me, Ira, by somebody from the British equivalent of the Audubon Society. That's the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds in the United Kingdom. That this could potentially help in the cleanup of those poor seabirds when they get contaminated by oil slicks.
Oh, and they get washed down with this magnetic soap.
Yeah, he suggested that maybe with the extra pull from the magnet, you would be able to clean off the poor birds more effectively than just using the traditional, dispersants. So I sent a grad student down to the store to get some lube oil and a pillow. We've taken it apart, and we're testing that idea right now with down from the pillows that we bought in the store.
I'm sure the grad students are doing it, right?
Sure.
once these things happen, like you never know where they're going to end up. I mean, the laser beam was invented to cut steel and razor blades with back in the early 60s, but look what it's used for now. You never know where your idea might wind up, where we'll end.
No, that's the really exciting thing about being a scientist, is that you uncover facts and figures that you just do not know where that will lead for the human race. Think about the liquid crystals, which were developed in the UK in the 1970s. When they developed liquid crystals, they had no idea that it would be an integral part of mobile phones and smartphones, for example. But they certainly don't work without liquid crystals to allow you to interface with the electronics through the screen.
This could be here
with this application, the applications that could come from this magnetic soap.
Now, let me ask you the $64 question, as we say here in the States. and it is a $64 question, I guess. Is it cheap enough?
It's interesting that what we started with are chemicals that are just the brothers and sisters of those that you would find in household products. We try to keep it simple here. And the cost of our magnetic soap is already reasonable. It's reasonable enough that it could actually be scaled up. Think that the elements that are contained in this soap are carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, chlorine, and iron. All very, very common elements, and therefore the soap that we've made is cheap, commercially viable.
Well, I wish you the best of luck, and we'll watch to see where your soap shows up, so to speak.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
It's been a great pleasure, Ira.
You're quite welcome. Julian Eastow is a professor in the School of Chemistry at the University of Bristol in the UK. You probably heard the news earlier this week. There was an explosion on the surface of the sun, a solar flare. And because we at Science Friday want to know how everything works and why, we're calling in a couple of experts to explain the ABCs of a solar storm and actually how the sun works. How good are we at predicting these solar explosions? What effects can they have on the Earth? Are there still some unsolved mysteries about the sun and how it works? Let me introduce my guest. David Hathaway is a solar astronomer at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Hathaway.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Doug Biesecker is a physicist at NOAA's Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder. He joins us from radio station KGNU in Boulder. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Biesecker.
Thanks for having me on the show, Ira.
You're welcome. David, can you give us a play-by-play of what happened there on the sun this week?
Yeah, it starts with a flash, a solar flare that we see particularly in X-rays from the sun, that the sun gets 100 to 1,000 times brighter than normal in X-rays from a sunspot region. With that, we saw that, of course, in the time it takes light to get from the sun, so 8.5 minutes or so. Mm-hmm. Within an hour, we saw radiation from it. This is energetic subatomic particles, electrons and protons and so forth. And that built up pretty steadily and stayed high for days. That whole explosion, it's a magnetic explosion on the sun, launched what we call a coronal mass ejection. This is literally a billion tons of matter moving at a million miles an hour. Streaming through the solar system and was aimed pretty much right at us. That hit us a couple days later and produced some spectacular auroral rays.
Mm-hmm. And is it going on still? Is there still activity going on?
Well, it's interesting you should ask. That one has since calmed down, but we are at this moment in the midst of an even bigger flare as far as X-rays, but it's off the edge of the sun, so we're not going to get the dramatic fireworks here on Earth from it. But we are at this moment in the midst of an X-ray flare that's even more powerful than the one from a few days ago.
Wow.
Ira, in addition to that, I just want to point out that the radiation storm is also in progress.
So we called you at the right time.
Indeed.
All right. We have a whole bunch of time to talk about it. So 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're going to talk about this new solar flare that's happening as we speak and bigger than the one that happened earlier this week. You can tweet us at SciFry at SCIFRI. And you can also go to our Facebook page and our website. So we'll be back talking more about solar flares with David Hathaway and Doug Biesecker. Our number again, 1-800-989-8255. We're in the middle of a big one, and we'll talk about it some more. Stay with us. Hi, SciFry fans. There's a new app in town. If you're listening to this on our SciFry iPhone or iPad app, there's a newer, better app waiting for you to download on iTunes, the SciFry Booster Edition. It's loaded with new features like playlists, Twitter, Facebook, and other goodies. It's optimized for your iPad. The videos look terrific. An Android app is in the works, too, so please be patient. For you iOS fans, just go to the iTunes Store and search for the SciFry BE app. That's the SciFry BE app. Download and enjoy. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about solar astronomy this hour with David Hathaway of NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center, Doug Biesecker at NOAA's Space Weather Prediction Center. Our number 1-800-989-8255, and we called them up originally to talk about this week's earlier solar flare, but we find out right now as we speak there's an even bigger one happening, although not the one that's pointed at us. It's not going to be hitting the Earth. Is that correct, Doug?
Right. So the active region, these regions of intense magnetic field that produce flares and give us the coronal mass ejections, the same region that gave us the activity earlier in the week has rotated in the 5 days since to where it's now seen at the edge of the sun. And so the coronal mass ejection associated with this big flare is headed off away from Earth. But even in spite of that, we see the direct X-rays and ultraviolet from the flare, and any radiation being accelerated by the coronal mass ejection can still make its way to Earth, and we're seeing both of those effects in progress.
And what effect would it have on Earth here?
Well, the flare, the main effect is an atmospheric one. And the way you might be concerned about that, well, really, you probably wouldn't be. But if you're somebody that uses high-frequency radio to communicate, say a ham operator, or you're in a ship at sea, or you're even in a plane flying, you know, across the Pacific Ocean right now, you'd find your high-frequency radio probably isn't working because of this solar flare. The way that works is the signal has to bounce off a layer in the atmosphere known as the ionosphere. And right now, the ionosphere is very different from its normal state. And that bounce of the radio signal doesn't happen. It, in fact, gets absorbed by the atmosphere. So HF user, high-frequency users in the Pacific right now are feeling the effects of this solar flare.
Were they warned about this one?
Well, predicting a solar flare would have happened today at 1:37 Eastern time, we're not there yet. What we do is we look at these regions of intense magnetic field, the sunspots, how many of them are there, how complex is the magnetic field contained within, how big is it? And from that, we can compute a probability. So much like you might hear 40% chance of rain tomorrow, we can also say, you know, 60% chance of solar flares tomorrow.
So people in that area that you're saying, pilots, whatever, who are flying, they may be having trouble and not knowing why, but probably predicting, uh-oh, another solar flare.
That's exactly right. But they have a workaround. As long as they can see those communication satellites that sit over the equator in geostationary orbit 22,000 miles above the surface of the Earth, they can switch to that SATCOM and still get the signal through.
David Hathaway, what is it on the sun that causes this thing to happen? What's going on in the internal workings of this?
It's magnetism, pure and simple. That it's magnetic fields involved in all of this. It's magnetic fields that make the sunspots themselves. That within the sun, the flow of these ionized, electrically charged gases produces intense magnetic fields, and in sunspots it gets to be, you know, thousands of times stronger than the Earth's own magnetic field, strong enough that, in fact, it chokes off the flow of heat from inside the sun, which is why sunspots appear dark. But those magnetic fields can get twisted out of shape and basically short-circuit by reconnecting, and all that magnetic energy gets released explosively. And so that's where it ultimately comes from, is magnetism ultimately produced inside the sun that we see manifest at the surface in sunspots and above the surface in coronal features, these loops where the gases in the sun's hot corona are confined to move along these magnetic loops above the surface. And so we can see the presence of the magnetic fields there. It's, again, magnetism's the key to it all.
Speaking of magnetism, does our Earth's magnetic field that surrounds it, does it protect us from any of these things?
Very much so, yeah. That the Earth's own magnetic field would normally look like a bar magnet's magnetic field, what we call a dipole field, you know, going into the north, coming out of the south. But because it's also subjected to the solar wind that blows off of the sun at a million miles an hour, that solar wind drapes the Earth's magnetic field into a comet-like structure, a tail. So it pushes the magnetic field on the day side closer to the Earth, and it stretches it out on the night side into a long tail and back of the Earth. So that magnetic field does protect us from charged particles, but it can also get disrupted by the magnetic fields in these coronal mass ejections, that when this magnetic explosion goes off, the coronal mass ejection that's produced has magnetic field is a key part of it, and that magnetic field, once it hits the Earth, if it's directed in the opposite way, if it's directed from north to south instead of south to north, it can produce reconnections in the Earth's magnetic field that ultimately lead to energetic particles, electrons and protons, streaming back along the Earth's magnetic field line into the atmosphere and producing the aurora.
Wow, that's terrific. Right. Doug, did you want to jump in there?
Well, I was going to say, in addition to the aurora, that when the coronal mass ejection slams into the Earth's magnetic field that does protect us from the radiation storm, that changing magnetic field causes problems for customers. That's why the Space Weather Prediction Center is monitoring the sun 24 hours a day to provide forecasts and get out those official watches, warnings, and alerts to customers, because when that coronal mass ejection hits the Earth, currents are being induced into the power grid. So the power system operators, with as little as 15 minutes of warning, can protect their systems by making sure they have sufficient capacity to handle the extra currents, to have people in place to turn off a transformer if it starts to overheat. So it's something industry can respond to. They just need to have the watches, warnings, and alerts to make sure they're able to.
Now, this one, if I heard you correctly, started less than an hour ago. And
that's right. And the solar
and so you weren't really able to get out. Your prediction is at what stage compared to, let's say, weather forecasting? What stage are you at predicting?
Well, I think the canonical thing people use is we're about 30 to 50 years behind weather forecasting. There are certain things where we're much better than that. With a coronal mass ejection, we can observe them back at the sun, and then we can predict with, in fact, a numerical model that we introduced on the Weather Service supercomputer just a couple of months ago. We can use that to predict when this coronal mass ejection would arrive at Earth. And the storm that erupted on Sunday, January 22nd, erupting at 11 p.m. Eastern Time, slammed into the Earth at 10 a.m. Tuesday, within an hour of when it was predicted.
And the one that's predicted less than started an hour ago, when is that going to slam into the Earth?
Well, that's the early indications are that, in fact, it won't. Because the active region has rotated away from an unfavorable position, that coronal mass ejection is going to fly harmlessly off into space, maybe hitting a science satellite or two on the way.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people don't realize that the sun actually rotates.
Yeah, the sun rotates
on its own axis. Yeah.
Every 27 days on average, and because of that rotation, and I'm going to give Dave the opportunity to jump in here and talk about why that's significant. That's one of the reasons why the sun is so interesting and we have a solar cycle.
Yeah, part of it is that because it's a ball of gas, it doesn't have to rotate like a solid ball. In fact, it doesn't. At the equator, it rotates once in about 24 days. As you get near the poles, it takes about 35 days. And so produces a shearing motion that things get stretched out and wrapped around the sun because of it. Things like magnetic fields in particular, and that's, in fact, a key part of how the magnetic fields are generated and maintained within the sun is this what we call differential rotation. The fact that the equator is rotating faster than the poles, there's a shear layer near the surface that as you start at the surface and move inward, the rotation speeds up, then stays constant through 100,000 miles or so, and then changes again at a layer about a quarter of the way into the sun. That rotation, in fact, is key to producing the magnetic fields.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Virginia in Flint, Michigan. Hi, Virginia.
Hi.
Hi there.
Fascinating stuff. We've had a really warm weather here in Michigan. Is this going to impact weather patterns? Like, are we going to have a really hot summer now? Or another question is this going to melt the melt the ice packs? And ozone and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if I've missed some of the answers already, but I'd be interested in how much it's going to melt, the ice that's already melting so fast.
Okay, Virginia, thanks for calling. We'll see what we
can
do.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are great questions. The sun does influence climate to some respect, but probably not weather as far as the day-to-day. that even though the sun got 100 times brighter in X-rays, it hardly got brighter at all when you add up all the energy that the sun puts out and the Earth receives. That's a tiny amount, even over the course of a complete sunspot cycle. When you go from no sunspots to, 100 sunspots on the sun and all of that activity, the sun's only about a tenth of a percent, one part in a thousand, brighter. Mm-hmm. And so it's a small change, has, again, in the long run, has a bit of an effect on climate, but day-to-day weather, probably not.
Mm-hmm. Here's some questions, a few questions, different questions, basically the same theme coming from the Internet. And people want to know how this would affect, a flare like this might affect people in space, either the space station or people, astronauts on their way to Mars or maybe on the moon, things like that.
Sure. Well, there certainly can be impacts. The astronauts on the International Space Station right now have to be concerned. But in general, do they need to be concerned from the activity that's happening right now? Not really. Their action, they would react at very, very large levels of radiation. There's a certain risk that they're willing to accept, a few extra or a slightly higher risk of cancer as they age. But the systems that they're using can be impacted by a radiation storm. So, mm-hmm. with the shuttle, for example, the robot arm couldn't be used when a radiation storm exceeded a certain level. Mm-hmm. So there are certain impacts they do have to be mm-hmm. aware of.
Tell us about this huge solar storm, the storm of 1859, Doug.
Well, 1859 was it's kind of our perfect storm in solar physics. So the day was Thursday, September 1st, and Sir Richard Carrington was in his house at his observatory watching the sun like he did every day, and he projected this image of the sun with his telescope till it was about 11 inches across, and each day he would draw the sunspots. And this particular day, he'd finished drawing the sunspots, and he was just about to start measuring the locations on the sun when all of a sudden two bright lights appeared in the middle of one of these magnetic regions he'd measured. And he'd never seen this before. And he thought, oh, there's something wrong with my equipment. And he checked it out and quickly realized, no, it's not my equipment. And the careful observer that he is, he wrote down the time, 11:20 a.m. He was so shocked by this, he ran off to find somebody to help verify what he was seeing. He couldn't find anybody, came back, and it was already fading. It lasted all of 5 minutes. By 11:25 a.m., it was done.
Let me just interrupt and say this is Science Friday from NPR. Talking with Doug Biesecker, spinning a yarn about the solar flare of 1859. Keep
right.
going.
So now He knew something special had happened, and what makes this really remarkable is at a magnetic observatory, again, when you shake the Earth's magnetic field, if you and I had a compass, it would point to solar north. But if you made a compass that was sensitive enough, you would be able to see that that magnetic field was shaking during one of these geomagnetic storms. And in fact, at 4 a.m. on September 2nd at the Magnetic Observatory at Kew Garden, there was a great magnetic storm. And Carrington said, a swallow doesn't make a summer, but there seems to be a connection here. So in just 17 hours after he saw a flare on the sun, we had a huge, in fact, the largest ever recorded magnetic storm on the surface of the Earth. It was so strong, every magnetic observatory in the world saturated except for one that we know in India, and all measurements of that storm are now based on that one.
And what impacts, what did it impact?
Right.
Telegraphs and things like that?
Right. So the technology of the day was telegraphs. So that's really where most of the impacts were. In Pittsburgh, the telegraph machines got so hot the operators couldn't touch them. In Philadelphia, a telegraph operator received a shock from his equipment. In Boston, there was a flame of fire. In telegraph stations up and down the East Coast, wood got scorched, paper burned. What did the average person see? Well, aurora. In Indianapolis, the aurora was so bright and so strong, You didn't have to look north to see the aurora. You could look at your southern horizon and still see the aurora. In Jamaica, it was described as like the light of a fire. It's believed that, well, in fact, it's been recorded that sailors saw it just 12 degrees north of the equator, and that if weather conditions had been favorable, it would have been seen even at the equator. So the entire globe was able to see the aurora on September 2nd, 1859.
Wow. Do we know why that happened in such a spectacular fashion?
This particular event was really just the extreme of exactly what happened just this past Sunday. Associated with that solar flare was one of these coronal mass ejections. The speed of the coronal mass ejection doesn't tell you exactly how strong the storm will be. For that, you need to know the magnetic field in the CME. But it's a pretty good indicator, and that transit of 17 hours is the fastest ever recorded. And the impulse, you know, the amount of energy that got dumped into the Earth's magnetic field was just incredible.
Do we have a number you could put on even a solar flare that this happened this week? How big an explosion goes on?
No, I don't have a number.
Dave,
that
you got
I could.
Well, yeah, typical flare, if you look at the radiant energy from it, is the equivalent of a million megatons of TNT. So that's the energy equivalent of 10 million Hiroshima bombs.
Wow. All right, we're going to let that sink in for a little bit. Take a break. We'll come back more and talk with Doug Biesecker and David Hathaway.
Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about solar flares and the sun with David Hathaway of NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville and Doug Biesecker of NOAA's Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder. And we're going to talk a few more minutes because I want to recap. If you just tuned in, there is a big solar flare happening right now in the sun, and maybe we can recap it. David, you want to take a shot at it? Or Doug, who would you like to tell us what's going on there now?
Well, Doug's probably better at that. He's on top of it.
Okay, Doug, bring us up to date.
Right, well, I was on top of it until I walked into the studio. But what we had on a scale of 1 to 5 remeasure space weather, and the solar flare we had last Sunday remeasured at 2 on our solar flare scale, or an R2. The flare we just had is even larger at the R3 level. Within 20 minutes of that solar flare erupting, we started to see radiation particles at very high energies that are starting to hit the Earth. The Space Weather Prediction Center, in our role, of course, put out a warning as soon as the flare began, and in fact put out warnings for the radiation storm before the particles even began to arrive.
Mm-hmm. And that happened today?
So that's happening right now. The flare itself is probably practically over.
Yeah,
the radiation storm will continue. It's hard for me to estimate without having seen the data recently how long that will continue. But what that would cause, potential impacts to that. When the radiation levels reach sufficient levels, those same particles that David talked about coming down and hitting the polar regions, causing the aurora, that also causes the high-frequency communications outages in the polar regions, and so any airplane flying over there loses their high-frequency radio. Mm. The problem there is they can't see those satellite communication satellites sitting over the equator, so in fact they have absolutely no way to communicate if they're in the polar regions during one of these storms, which is why it's important that they get the information as quickly as possible, because if they have to divert one of those routes, it's not very cost-effective.
David, do you want to add anything?
No, it's just I wanted to mention that I am in my office, so I can see the data, and the X-rays are well on their way going down, but the energetic particles, protons in particular, are rising rapidly.
Here, reaching us on Earth.
Yes. These are being measured as we speak at satellites in geosynchronous orbit.
How many watchdog satellites do we have out there?
Well, NOAA, those same weather satellites that are taking pictures of the hurricanes, we have space weather sensors on those. And, in fact, the flare and the radiation storm are being measured with instruments on those same weather satellites. Mm-hmm. But we do leverage assets from NASA, for example. The coronal mass ejection that's associated with this flare, we know it's headed nowhere towards Earth because we've got images of the solar atmosphere from a NASA satellite that show us that's what's happening. And we also use those data to help forecast when those coronal mass ejections will hit the Earth.
Well, we'll be watching over the next hours, and people will, I guess, listen to Science Friday, will know about it because this word is coming out. It happened within, just a little bit over an hour ago. And thank you, gentlemen, for taking time to alert us.
Thank you, Ira, for having us on.
You're welcome. David Hathaway is solar astronomer at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. And Doug, thank you. Doug Biesecker is physicist at NOAA's Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder, Colorado.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Imagine walking into Jamba Juice for your favorite smoothie fix, and when it's time to pay, instead of pulling out cash or a credit card, you just tap your phone on a reader, and you're ready to go. Better yet, when you tap your phone to pay, it also redeems an electronic coupon stored in your phone, so you end up paying even less. Yeah, well, people, in fact, can already do this at Jamba Juice using Google Wallet on certain Android phones. You can use it at Macy's, Bloomingdale's, Duane Reade. We're not doing a commercial here. We're just telling you that it's spreading. The list is going on. And AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, they've all teamed up to launch their own version of something called the Mobile Wallet. It's going to be finding its place everywhere later this year. But how safe is my banking information stored in my mobile wallet, and what's going on in it? And what's in it for me besides the coupons? Here to talk about it is Giles Eubanks. He is lead analyst for cards and payments at Data Monitor in London. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there, Ira. Thanks for having me.
How ubiquitous is this now?
It's still very, very early days. It's still quite in its nascent phase of development. What you're seeing at the moment now is, you know, it's been years in the making. This is something people have been talking about, this sort of technology, for at least 10, 15 years now. But it's only now that it's really starting to finally hit the market. But even then, it's not quite the big bang that many people are hoping. It's slowly creeping out. Where these things are actually rolling out now, it tends to be focused much more on big urban centers.
Right.
And even there, you know, the U.S. is much more advanced than quite a few other countries are, at least compared to Europe. You need to look a bit further afield to countries like Japan and South Korea, see really what that kind of environment really exists like once it's been in place for a few years.
And what is the benefit for me as a consumer in doing this?
Well, this is, you know, that's a big question. That's a, you know, very strong one, which I'm not 100%, you know, sure that anyone has actually answered that quite yet. It's, you know, it's the key thing that, you know, everyone will keep saying in the industry is it all boils down to convenience. You know, there's this weird notion within the sector that people love their mobile phones, and they have to make payments. So they'll love using their mobile phones to make payments. I don't think the connection is necessarily that one-to-one. Now, where it does become more interesting is exactly what, you know, Google's doing. It's, I think very much the big attraction is when you can add in that extra functionality, right? Because, you know, these handsets, these cell phones, which everyone has, they're becoming increasingly powerful. It's not just about making the payments anymore. It's when you can suddenly start tying that into, you know, your location, you know, any kind of loyalty programs you may have. It could even be, you know, identification, kind of access control. Mm. And, you know, it all starts tying together. It all starts becoming very personalized.
Yeah. If you take this to the next step, why do you even need the checkout counter at all? Why can't you just take your can of peas, put your cell phone on it, it takes a picture of the barcode, and you pay for it right there? You walk out of the store.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. Apple has actually released something like this quite recently. They have an Apple App Store app, you know, for the iPhone, which you can download. They've started trialing in a few cities. It's service where it doesn't use the actual NFC contactless chip, but what you can do is you can actually go into the store, take a photo, you scan the barcode, and you can pay for it right then and there, you know, using your iTunes account, and that's it. You walk out. you get your receipt emailed to you. I don't actually know how the security works on that. I don't know how they stop, you know, kind of shoplifters from just walking off with everything under the sun. But I do know, you know, they'll have certain parameters in there to stop people from, you know, walking off with laptops. I think you need, you know, someone from the shop to actually help you with those. But, you know, if you just wanted to buy a pair of headphones, you can do that. That actually exists today.
Is all that information on our phone safe? I mean, and safe for us, for we consumers?
Actually, it surprisingly is quite safe. It's the real focus for the contactless mobile side of things, something called the NFC chip that stands for Near Field Communications. Now, what that chip does, it sits separate. It's its own little chip within the handset, which it's very, very secure. That's why it becomes suitable to use for things like payments. But it extends quite, you know, a bit further than that. I've just read today there's the big airport technology software provider, SITA, has been trialing a proof of concept for NFC mobile contactless ticketing, you know, that includes check-in, boarding, and even lounge access.
I guess here's a tweet that came in. Somebody wants to know what happens when you lose your phone. And it's got all that information in the phone, your bank account and all that kind of stuff. Is there a security risk there?
Oh, there is. I mean, there always is, right? I mean, if you carry a wallet, that's a security risk as well. You could drop it on the bus. You could fall out anywhere. The big difference is, you know, with the handset, you can switch it off. You know, it's what a lot of handsets can do now. What I would actually recommend to most of your listeners, you know, make sure you do have a PIN that you can actually put on there to actually, you know, to open the whole thing. Yeah, but a really interesting statistic is, you know, the average amount of time it takes someone to realize they've lost their wallet is something like 5 or 6 hours. It takes people about 15 minutes to realize their phone's missing.
Oh, that is better. Yeah. then the panic sets in.
Yeah, exactly. You
panic earlier. So what is the future? So the mobile wallet, basically we just sit back and wait for it to hit us?
Well, it's... I think what you're going to see happening now is you're going to start seeing a lot of products launching over the next few years. But the actual, you know, the market, how it's going to work, that's not settled yet. You know, I think kind of the user actual, you know, experience, how it actually works, you know, how many buttons you need to push to actually switch the thing on, I think it still has a long way to go. It could happen very quickly. I mean, if Apple launches something that's very slick in the next 6 months, you know, I could picture everyone imitating that very quickly. But I think it's going to be more of a slow burn. You know, there's a lot of breathless estimations that, you know, the wallet is going to be obsolete. You know, 10, 15 years from now, no one will be carrying a wallet. But if you look at it this way, you know, people still wear wristwatches. You know, it's not quite ready. I don't know if consumers will ever be ready to just fully abandon, you know, more traditional means.
Yeah, we said that about green cash when the credit cards came in, and there's still a little bit of that lying around.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Thank you, Giles.
Yep, no problem.
Giles Eubanks is lead analyst for cards and payments at Data Monitor in London. Time now for our video pick of the week. Flora Lichtman, our multimedia editor, is here. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
Good video, as always.
Yeah, this one is about something that I encounter every day, and I think of it as little more than a beverage cooler or maybe a nuisance on my commute to work. I'm talking about ice, but it turns out that ice was way more interesting than I knew before doing this video.
You got up close and personal with a bunch of ice, didn't
you?
Yeah,
I did. So we went to Shintaro Okamoto's ice sculpting studio in Queens, and so he is an ice expert for sure. And we also spoke with an ice researcher, the head of Dartmouth's ice research lab. I didn't even know there was such a thing as an ice research lab, but this guy, Erlen Schulzen, actually founded it and learned about ice's slippery properties. I mean that figuratively, too.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Flora Lichtman, who's discovering that ice is an amazing, isn't it?
It's amazing
substance.
I heard from both of these ice experts, who are experts in these sort of different ways, right? One's an artist and the other's a scientist. But they both said the same thing, that ice is full of these mysterious contradictions. For instance, ice can be cloudy or it can be crystal clear. Ice can be as soft as a snowflake or as hard as concrete.
Wow. And you went to his their studio where they have these chainsaws buzzing
well,
and cutting
thing.
Up the ice, making sky sculptures, right?
When you're dealing with something as hard as concrete, you have to bring on some serious power tools. And so they said that actually 60 to 70% of the sculpting work is done with chainsaws, sort of brute work, says Shintaro Okamoto.
The process is quite kind of brute, you know, with these power tools. And the finished product is so much about this kind of fragility and, you know, elegance. And it's kind of funny to see some of these ice sculptors who like present themselves as this like this macho guys and they create hearts and swans, you know.
And what did they create for you over there?
We saw a couple things in action, some lions that were headed to the Ritz-Carlton, and then a dragon for Chinese New Year that was going to the Waldorf Astoria. And it took a couple hours to do the sculpting. And once you start, obviously, you're not going to get stopped because it's melting as they're sculpting.
And you saw, we see the video there, and then we see the some commentary about the physics of ice and how it forms.
Yeah. One of the most interesting things I learned, did you know this, why ice is cloudy and some ice is clear?
Yeah, you notice that.
You see it all the time, but what I found out the answer. It turns out that it's tiny air bubbles trapped in the ice that makes the difference between cloudy and clear ice. So cloudy ice has these little bubbles trapped, and that scatters the light. Mm-hmm. So for Okamoto, there's ways to make ice, specialty ice, with no bubbles. But, you know, we learn about that.
He's making 300-pound slabs.
It's not your average ice cube.
But one thing in the video, I saw a video, besides him covering up the ice, is that he has to let the ice sort of sit for a while, right? The giant block of ice, you just can't hack at it. It has to, like, cure or
acclimate. Yeah, I like the curing.
It has to acclimate.
Yeah, it can't, because it's all, so this is another sort of interesting material science thing. It comes out of the freezer and it's all one temperature, right? And it's really cold. And even on a day like we were there, it was in the 40s maybe in the studio, which is another thing. But you have to let the ice warm up. And if you cut into it too quickly, it'll crack and burst. And that's because as it's warming up, the outer layer is actually warming up faster than the inside. And as it warms up, it expands. And so it creates this strain between the outer skin of the ice and the inner part. And this is apparently what causes cracks on ponds, too. That's what Erlen Schulzen said.
Yeah, so you're learning when you watch this video. It's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. And as you watch the ice sculpture going on, Flora has magically integrated some wonderful commentary about what the physics of ice and how it all works.
I snuck in a tiny bit of science.
There's a lot of, Well, it's beautiful. The stuff that they make is absolutely gorgeous. They do it quickly, right?
It's really fun to watch them work. It's really fast.
And, you know, they have no goggles on. First thing, ice is flying all over the place.
And chainsaws everywhere. I mean, you said dueling chainsaws in the promotion. That's totally right. It was scary, like, all the time sort of wielding these power tools.
Mm-hmm. And so you get a lesson and watch the ice sculpture. At the same time, you learn a little bit about how ice is formed and how you make clear ice and all kinds of good stuff. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
It's up there at our website at sciencefriday.com, and you could download it on iTunes. Also have videos there and take it along with you on your iPod or iPad, and take along also all kinds of stuff with you on our website. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Taliata and Alessio Bayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. I'm Ira Flato. Thanks for listening.